Hello and welcome to the Investment Hour, this week kicking off our new series, The New Future.
Yes, I'm very excited about the series, which focuses on the theme that destruction can clear the path to innovation, and has done so repeatedly in the past. So for all the challenges of coronavirus, the crisis also provides multiple opportunities for renewal.
It's an idea which has been discussed at length by many leading economists, among them Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz.
If you borrow money for investing in the future, that makes you stronger if you invest well. Every company does that, and society as a whole through the government needs to do that.
And by our own resident economist Chris Dillow, who we have spoken to this week.
One big reason why productivity stagnated was precisely that firms weren't going out of business sufficiently and weren't being supplanted by more efficient startups. And that problem is going to be even greater because of the lockdown.
We will also be talking to Alex Newman about opportunities for technological renewal post-coronavirus. And later we'll be joined by Algie Hall to discuss how we can apply this thinking to our investing. I'm John Heumann.
And I'm Megan Boxall.
Welcome to the Investment Hour.
The Investment Hour. 60 minutes of money with the Investors Chronicle.
So, Megan, tell us where this feature idea came from.
Well, it's something that we've sort of been discussing for a while, and it's been lots of conversations about sort of the progress of coronavirus. It's kind of evolved as coronavirus has evolved. And we started, obviously, a few weeks back we wrote a feature looking at a changed world and the changes that are currently happening, changes in behaviour that are currently happening because of coronavirus, because of the lockdown measures. That has led on to further discussions about whether or not these behavioural changes will become permanent. And I think the longer we've been in lockdown for, the more we've thought, no, they're not all going to be permanent. We're not all going to be working from home all the time because it's quite trying at times. But there are some things which have, some parts of the coronavirus pandemic, which have really shown up weaknesses and things that need to be changed, things that have been needed to be changed for a very long time, from individual companies to entire economies. And the fact that these issues have been shown up by the coronavirus is potentially an opportunity for building back better. That was the original idea. It's something that a lot of people are talking about all the time in policy and things, and that's sort of the basis of this series of features.
So the idea could be that the future looks very different in some ways, not always, to the one we have now, hence the new future, as we've called the series. What sort of things are we going to be looking at?
What makes this series so interesting is that it can be applied to so many different industries, and I think a really good starting point is climate change. As we heard from Joseph Stiglitz there at the beginning, that little clip, he talks a lot about the fact that after the economic damage caused by coronavirus, we should be building a stronger economy with the climate and with green energy and things in mind. So that's a starting point. That's going to be the next article. We'll also look at healthcare. Obviously, that's a massive topic. Supply chains, finance, fintech.
Corporate governance. There was a really interesting story in the magazine this week written by Mark Robertson, his Taking Stock column, about Compass raising some money. And it's the first company to offer, through an accelerated book build placing, a proportion to retail investors. And that's a fintech story. And it's ripped up the old rules, and it's the way things should go.
Well, that's what I think was really interesting about what's happening at the moment, because a lot of these potential processes were in place. Like, fintech's not a new thing, but they weren't being used right. And a lot of that was laziness. A lot of that was because people were just sort of accepting the old. And now that we've been forced to change the way that we behave, it's shown that we don't have to accept what was happening before. And yeah, that Compass thing, it's a really good example of taking new innovation and applying it to a process at fundraising. They've been in place for ages. They've been in place forever, for as long as the stock market has been around for. But this is the first time that this fintech has been used in that way, and that's really positive. And it's something that all companies should arguably be doing in the future.
I spoke to one of his directors, a guy called James Deal, who, funnily enough, I used to work with. And, you know, he is very obviously very pleased that they've got this deal away with Compass, but they've been speaking to lots of people. There was a lot of resistance to using this platform. And it seemed to come, which is called Primary Bid, incidentally. And it seemed to be coming from the vested interests that were involved in the process as it used to be. The world's changed now for them.
Yeah. No, it's true across so many different sectors. These new innovations can really come into their own, and yeah, that's something that I spoke to Chris Diller about earlier this week. Hi Chris, thanks very much for joining us. I mean, what a fascinating time to be studying, analysing, writing about economics. Does this compare to anything you've ever covered before?
Honestly, no. In the sense that, well, obviously we've had lots of recessions before, and just like this one, they've all been unpredicted and unpredictable. But we've never had one in which a decline in output is seen as necessary on health grounds. And in that respect, it's unprecedented, not only in my rather lengthy career, but in economic history.
What seems to really characterise this more than previous economic crashes is the sudden impact it's had on everyone's everyday, and most notably in the job sector. What worries you most about the extent of the job losses, or the potential job losses during or because of coronavirus and the lockdown?
Well, the mere fact of job losses is itself very concerning, simply because one thing we know for sure is that unemployment is a huge source of unhappiness. You know, so the human cost of unemployment is immense. Second thing that concerns us is that, especially in the UK, unemployment is associated with a huge loss of income, and that means a loss of revenue for other people. And so that there is a danger that the unemployment will lead to further weakness in demand. And the other problem is, when the lockdown ends, will demand recover sufficiently to get the unemployed back into work? And this is a really tricky one, because official macroeconomic forecasts, for what they're worth, which isn't very much, expect that unemployment will stay above its pre-lockdown peak for another couple of years. But another problem on top of this is the pattern of demand. It's quite likely that pubs and restaurants will not go back to pre-crisis levels of demand, and therefore to pre-crisis levels of employment. And this means that people who did work in those industries are going to have to find work elsewhere. And this runs the danger of there being a mismatch between jobs and vacancies. Even if vacancies bounce back, which is by no means assured, the people who are unemployed might be a poor match for the jobs that are available.
So do you see that shift happening? I mean, where do you see that shift happening, that where demand for jobs may be opening up? Is that potentially more of a skilled sector? I mean, and the lower skilled jobs maybe dwindling?
Well, honestly, we don't know. We don't know how much this recession is going to lead to permanent changes in demand. You know, it's quite possible that it will lead to less eating out and less drinking out. But what it will lead to more of is frankly anybody's guess. And I think we must, even more so than usual, but be humble about our powers of foresight.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that is a very sensible point. But obviously, people are sort of making calls about what they think may come. And I mean, we're doing it too with the IC. You can't help but speculate about what might come next.
You can help but speculate. You've got to remember that a story isn't necessarily the truth. And we've got to remember, because surely the one thing this crisis has taught us is that our powers of foresight are much smaller than we thought.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, goodness, if someone had predicted this, even in January, the extent of the fallout, especially in the UK and the US, people would have said they were mad. They would have, dismissed it.
Yeah, the only reason nobody said that anyone was mad was that nobody was forecasting.
Yeah. Yeah. You opened your IC article this week talking about the fact that startup businesses fail anyway. Why do you think that what's happening with coronavirus is more worrying than the general ebb and flow of startups?
Yeah, well, to see this, you've got to remember that loads and loads of businesses fail every year, right? Some slightly more than one in ten shut down, even in good times. Now, the reason that doesn't normally lead to rising unemployment is that even more firms start up. Something like one firm in eight is less than a year old. Yeah. Now, my concern is that the suddenness of this recession and the fall in demand might prevent startups running at their normal rate. So everybody's attention is on job losses and what can be done to prevent job losses. But that's only half the story of economic growth, and it's only half the story of how unemployment changes. The other half of the story is new businesses starting up. And any potential entrepreneur might wonder, what's the point of starting a new business if the lockdown could come again in the autumn? Or if, you know, the business which is running perfectly well could get wiped out by the sort of bolt from the blue that we've seen this year.
Yeah, so you talk about the macroeconomic policy and a lot of the measures that are being put in place at the moment, the furlough scheme, the support for individuals and for businesses being just as important, as you say, for the future as it is for the current job protection. So what do you think in terms of that policy, the government policy, what should they be thinking about next and to support that continued progression of a good startup market in the UK?
Well, I think what they've got to do is to give maximal support for startups. And that doesn't just mean running the economy hot because the number of startups isn't particularly cyclical. What it means is being very clear about removing any obstacle to new business startups, you know, making sure that they have low overhead and they get support on rates, maybe not paying rates as is currently the case for smaller firms, making sure that rents aren't extortionate and making sure that finance is in place. There might well be a case for the government guaranteeing loans not only to existing businesses as it currently does, but to new ones as well. I think there's going to have to be a much greater focus on how to encourage new businesses.
Would you say that encouraging new business and encouraging entrepreneurship innovation is something that the UK in the last 10, 20 years has been good at or bad at? I mean, growth hasn't been particularly spectacular here, especially compared to what you see in America.
True. And in particular, productivity growth for the last 10 years has been pretty much non-existent. And that's a sign of a failure of competition and a failure of innovation.
So how do we make that better? Could Coronas be a restarting, a refreshing point to stimulate some innovation and some entrepreneurial spirit?
Well, I would have thought so, but so far attention isn't sufficiently on this question. Instead, attention is focusing on how to protect jobs, which, like I say, is only half the story. You know, and there is a lot that can be done in principle to support entrepreneurship, as I say, ensuring low rents, support for rates and such like. In the past, there's been a tendency to overemphasise tax breaks as a way of incentivising entrepreneurship, which I would have thought would be a low priority, given that the problem with a lot of small firms is that they're not earning enough to pay any tax, or at least in sufficient amounts, you know.
Yeah. It's a point, this sort of regrowth angle, which we're talking about a lot in the magazine at the moment, but it's also something that economists have talked about for a long time. And Joseph Stiglitz is one of the economists who, even before the coronavirus came along, he was talking about a momentous occasion for green initiatives to stimulate some innovation. And this also relates to what other economists have said in the past, talking about creative destruction, which was Joseph Schumpeter's idea about building things back better. Is now a moment for what Schumpeter was talking about?
Yes, I think you could see the history of the last 10 years, even before coronavirus, as being a decline in the pace of creative destruction. And one big reason why productivity stagnated was precisely that firms weren't going out of business sufficiently and weren't being supplanted by more efficient startups. And that problem is going to be even greater because of the lockdown. It's far easier to see what the problem is than to see precise solutions to it. We know the outline of the solutions, you know, but there is a lot of uncertainty about what is most important. And I suspect that what we need here are broad spectrum policies, you know, doing everything we can to support entrepreneurs in different ways. There's no magic single bullet.
No, but yeah, just briefly going back to Schumpeter, I mean, a point that you disagree with the famous economists on is the monopoly powers, and then yeah, what you said again about competition. There is an argument that monopoly powers can help stimulate growth because they are so good that they sort of keep building and they keep innovating. And I mean, what we see in the US in the tech sector in particular at the moment, especially in Alphabet and in Amazon, they are monopolies in their respective sectors, but they're also innovating incredibly outside their sectors. Is that a danger? Do you think that is stifling the ability of other smaller companies to get going?
Yeah, I mean, you say they're innovating, but I'm not entirely sure that's the case. And what a lot of them are good at is buying up potential rivals, which might actually slow down the pace of innovation. And if you just look at the big facts, fact is that over recent years, the US economy has become more monopolistic. And yet, growth in things like GDP per head and productivity is actually slower now than it was before the crisis. So this alerts us to the fact that monopolies might not be good for economic growth. And there's lots of reasons for that. In one way in which monopolies use their cash isn't just to buy up potential rivals, but also to lobby governments for greater protection in the form of copyright laws and intellectual property restrictions and so on. And the US healthcare industry, for example, spends $500 million a year on lobbying government. And it alone employs 5 lobbyists for every single congressman. Now, they're not doing that in order to ensure healthy economic growth, are they?
No, I suspect not. But then the alternative is shifting into regulation, and tightly regulated industries also struggle with innovation and clamping down on what the tech giants in the US in particular might be able to do, and the profits that they might be able to generate. Surely that would be stifling for their ability to keep innovating.
Not necessarily. I mean, we're in the realm here of the second best. I mean, we know from economic theory that if there is a market imperfection somewhere, and monopoly is pretty obviously a market imperfection, then what looks like another market imperfection can actually help to move us closer to full efficiency.
Well, Chris, thanks very much for joining us. That was a really fascinating conversation. And
thank you.
So that was a very interesting discussion, obviously, with Chris. And the overriding point there, I think, that he was making at the end was the dangers of monopoly powers, which is something that is particularly prescient in the technology industry, especially in the US. And that's part of the focus of something that Alex Newman has written about this week in his Future Technology piece, which works very well with the overall theme of this new series. Thanks for joining us, Alex, to have a chat about technology.
No problem.
Technology is sort of at the core of this whole theme. It's so relevant in almost every industry and becoming increasingly so. Alex, do you want to just maybe talk about what the situation is with the technology and why this has become such a massive topic?
there's lots of different things we can talk about when we talk about technology. But I mean, with this piece, I tried to look at two of the big pictures, or the two of the big ideas that people have for the coming years and decades, and specifically how they relate to technology. So the first is probably the most prominent, and it is both kind of exciting, sometimes scary to many people, and also, you know, quite baffling. Those are sort of some of the kind of what I've called the techno-utopian forecasts put forward by, you know, futurists like the Silicon Valley inventor and Google associate Ray Kurzweil. So he has a very good track record of accurately calling technological progress. And in the past, these have tended to focus on things we sort of now take for granted, like improvements in computer processing power, you know, which actually follow very predictable patterns, and as well as the way that technologies from different fields converge. But some of his predictions for the next 20 years they're really quite staggering, and they challenge many of the sort of fundamental things we think about what it means to be human, let alone what it means for investing. Things about, you know, longevity being extended almost indefinitely, in, you know, virtual reality being indistinguishable from real life, as well as, you know, lots of other predictions. And the other big sort of story that some people tell about the future is decidedly more pessimistic. And some people, including, and we talk about the economist Robert Gordon in the piece, suggest that actually technology is, in relative terms, when we look back to the progress, technological progress we've seen in the last 150 years, is actually stagnating, and that we no longer really see the leap forward that really count for economies, productive output, and investors. So that one is to be too schematic. Those are the two ideas we've tried to talk about in the piece as they relate to technology.
That second point I found so interesting in the whole argument about creative destruction and where we are and what the opportunities that might be being brought about by coronavirus are, because the fact that he is talking about progress in the last 50 years not being as rapid as it was in the previous 50 years seems pretty extraordinary when you think about how far things like data collection have come on now. But actually, in terms of how we are living, the example he used was things like the motor car and things like that, were if you fell asleep at the start of the century and you woke up 50 years later, the progress would have been huge. But if you fell asleep at the end of the Second World War and you woke up now, actually there hasn't been that many things that aren't recognisable. But maybe that does relate to the fact that we've kind of got stuck in a rut of innovation, and now is an opportunity to sort of drive some of those really big things that are being talked about. Yeah, the AI, the longevity, the healthcare side of things, and it could be a real moment for acceleration in technology.
Yeah, it's a very interesting inflection point we're at the moment, and in a sense that some of the things that Robert Gordon is talking about, some of the things that Ray Kurzweil are talking about, they're kind of at cross purposes, because Robert Gordon is talking about primarily the effects on the economy and productivity, and you know, he looks at things like smartphones. Well, if it leaves us all more distracted and more likely to crash our cars because we're checking our you know, the messages just come through on WhatsApp, then arguably innovation does not necessarily mean enhancements in productivity, economic growth. They can be novelties in a sense. And you know, he also discusses renewable energy, which we look at in the piece, which, you know, I would argue there are, you know, any energy investor really, really have to pay attention to renewable energy and the way it's going to, you know, it is already disrupting in a profound way how we understand and invest in energy. But it doesn't necessarily lead to ever productivity growth. We're just having costs coming down further and further. So it is, you know, it is an interesting alternative take on, you know, certainly compared to some of the monumental shifts which really happened to the Western world at the beginning of the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th, when we had mass movement to urban environments. We had the, you know, the telegram and other changes in telecommunications, which, you know, it meant that you go from a very long lag time in the speed of travel of communication to instantaneous almost. And you can only really do that once. So some technological gains can't be repeated, really. And that's another one of Gordon's points.
Funny enough, I watched a very interesting film on Netflix this week called The Current War, which is about the battle between Edison and Westinghouse, about the electrical system that they would grow in America. That, I mean, electricity was a massive thing, a massive turning point. You know, Edison, they wanted to end the night. I thought that was, it's absolutely fascinating. One thing I'm struck by when, you know, we hear the sort of view of Robert Gordon is that, you know, if technology isn't delivering these sort of economic benefits, why are tech shares the biggest shares in the market? Why is the whole market built around the Googles and Apples and Facebooks and such the like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. And it would be foolish to suggest that these companies aren't driving innovations which aren't really, really useful to our lives and incredibly useful for the way businesses do things. But I suppose it's kind of a question of incremental gains, in that we've had the ICT revolution now for several decades. They don't necessarily, you know, you can only sort of make that step change to everyone having computers once. And just because things get faster and data gets more intelligent doesn't necessarily lead to productivity gains. I mean, obviously, the question, you know, the sort of tantalizing prospect that is always dangled by the Silicon Valley type futurists is what happens when, you know, supercomputing power comes along? Do things, you know, will we have in the next 20 years another invention equivalent to the step change brought about by electricity? So again, like I said, it's an interesting inflection point. And, you know, there's probably elements of you know, both of the futures that we've been talking about, which are likely to play out, and some elements which will probably be held back.
Yeah, that point about the innovations coming out of big tech companies not necessarily having a huge role in productivity, that's something that Chris was talking about. And when I put to him that they're being extremely innovative, these big tech companies, he questioned, were they really? Are they really being that innovative? And it's true. It's hard to actually see much innovation that is coming from those companies in terms of bringing new products to market. I mean, Google's still making most of its money from an invention that came around 20 years ago. But yeah, if it is a step change, then all of these companies, or most of them, are investing in seriously exciting things, in driverless vehicles, in AI. And I think you mentioned that, Alex, as well, that even when we're talking about like extremely novel ideas, it's a lot of these massive companies which are actually driving a lot of that investment and a lot of that innovation.
We talk about a book written by one of Ray Kurzweil's associates in the piece, and it's called The Future is Faster Than You Think. So it's published just before the pandemic, you know, changed our whole view of the world. But you definitely come away from reading that book with the idea that the options to put your money are pretty much confined to about 10 companies, you know, on NASDAQ, you know, most of whom I'm sure you've spoken about when you were talking about the bangs, and that really there's, you know, innovation outside of this small pool is either just going to be swallowed up or, you know, co-opted in some way by, you know, an Amazon and a Google or an Apple. The other thing you come away with, or I came away with reading this book, is that some of these very, very hyped projections for technological development and, you know, inventions sometimes feel like they, you know, that they sideline or neglect, you know, society and politics. So, you know, even if I'm prepared to accept some of the predictions like virtual reality is going to become indistinguishable, or that, you know, at some point in the next 20 years, I'm going to be able to upload my mind to the cloud. You know, is that something really that society wants? I mean, your point about autonomous cars, we basically have the technology there. And you know, we thought that was going to be the really hard part, is developing the technology. But it seems to me that the hard part is really going to be selling the idea of cars driving around without drivers. And that actually technological progress doesn't, you know, is in isolation sometimes removes the you know, the crucial ingredient, which is there a market for this? And for investors, that's, you know, that's a really important question, you know, when you're looking at some of these really hyped technologies, battery storage or supercomputing or the, you know, the what AI can do, you know. And if society is not prepared to accept some of this, then it's debatable whether, you know, some of these propositions are investable.
I mean, it's interesting, Alex. You look at something in the future called Amara's Law, which is how human beings think about the future and the way technology is going to change it. And this is of real relevance to investors and the way we think about technology and what may happen in the future in terms of investment. we kind of get it wrong a lot. Tell us why.
Yeah, so Amara's Law is named after another futurist. I suppose the way I refer to some of these insights as utopian is, you know, I'm myself guilty therefore of a kind of value judgment expressing some cynicism against some of these technologies, and sort of guilty of one of the things we see, which is typical behavioral trait in investors and really everyone, in the way they look at technological progress. So we first tend to get very over-optimistic about the potential for a technology. I think supercomputers, you know, are probably a good example of that right now. But progress doesn't move in a straight line, but it does tend to move forward because we don't get worse at developing supercomputers or technologies, and we learn by doing it. But there always reaches a sort of peak of pessimism where a technology doesn't seem to be delivering. But actually, that could be a really good time to potentially invest, because over time, you know, as these technologies develop further into the future, we actually tend to underestimate their capacity. And to my mind, one of the best examples of this trend at the moment is the way solar energy has exploded in the last decade. So in 2010, you know, the global installed capacity of solar energy was really a footnote in the energy mix. And it still makes up quite a small proportion of the global energy mix now. So it's easily overlooked. But if you look back at the way the market has evolved, it's exhibited a learning rate of about 30 to 40%. So for every doubling in installation or cumulative installation capacity, it has cut costs by between 30 and 40%. So if we run that forward and assume a fairly conservative rate of growth for solar power, by the end of 2040, you know, some people are projecting that, you know, even the most expensive solar energy in the world will be below the operating costs of even the cheapest existing fossil fuels. And you know, the writing is going to be on the wall long before that, and, you know, particularly if we solve intermittency issues. But because we think about the future in a linear way, it's very hard to see some of these experiential learning curves play out in the future and imagine what the effects are going to be like. So, but, you know, the lesson of the past century is that experiential learning is a real principle of emergent and developing technologies.
That's a really fascinating point. And I think the whole article is, it's really thought-provoking, especially at a time like this when we're all sort of, it feels like everyone is making big assumptions. And like you say, often it is based on technology which has existed for a while, but whether or not that the demand is there. And maybe this is the point. Maybe this is the catalyst which changes demand, changes the way things are regulated and looked at, data being a massive thing that we're changing the way we're thinking about using data. Because actually, when you track data for pushing out advertising, that doesn't feel particularly useful or good for individuals. But actually, if we're going to track people's personal data for the use of their health, then maybe people will be slightly more lenient about it. So yeah, it does feel like there are changes coming based on things that have happened, technological progress, which has already happened.
Yeah, one of the big hope from COVID-19 is that, you know, we see the massive amount we've spent across the world in panic fixing the problem, is that if there is a step change in our attitudes to research and development and in general science, that actually could spur a wave of innovation, which we've arguably not seen for several decades. So, you know, that could just be only a compounding factor of the sort of technological innovations we tend to forget about, which are actually happening as well. So, yeah, I don't think all is lost from 2020.
That's a nice positive note to end on. Thanks very much, Alex, for joining us.
Thank you.
The Investment
Hour. So I'm now joined by Algie Hall. How are you doing, Algie?
Yeah, good, thanks, John.
Excellent. Yeah, and we've been spending the last 45 minutes talking about the future and what life might look like after COVID. And a big part of that is the green economy and what might happen there, the Green New Deal, as some people have been describing it. And green is the subject of your ideas farm this week, by coincidence.
Yes,
happy
it is,
coincidence.
By coincidence. Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things we're doing in the ideas farm, we're looking at fund manager best ideas, top fund manager best ideas, and we're going green this week, looking at UK green ideas. I mean, you know, companies which can really tap into this theme are extremely exciting. And obviously, you know, there's the point that the green agenda may get a big boost from what's happening now, because essentially this lockdown reminds people that we live in it, you know, in an environment, in an ecosystem. And, you know, we've got, I'm sitting here today, you know, it's in, you know, it's May and the weather's like, it's like a very hot summer's day and it's forecast to carry on being that way for a long time. I mean, you know, there are lots of reasons to think something rather odd is going on. Yeah, companies which can, you know, actually intelligently offer solutions and create advantages for themselves from the kind of new green agenda could do extremely well. But I mean, there's also inside that there's going to be lots of greenwashing, lots of companies which essentially try and tick boxes to make themselves look like they're green businesses, but they don't actually do anything very special. They're not going to make money out of the green agenda. They're just going to, you know, spend money trying to look good.
Yeah, so this was something that you wrote about in a feature a while back, Green is Good, with, where we put Gordon Gekko on the cover. And I think if I remember rightly, what you were looking at there was the sort of green factors that matter. And I guess the big question for investors in this new green future is how they tell the difference between companies that are genuinely green and will profit as a result of it and those that are just window dressing.
Yeah, no. I mean, that is the question. The term that's used is materiality, whether companies are looking at addressing material issues for their businesses when they're announcing green initiatives. And you know, it's often quite hard to tell. You know, lots of stuff sounds good, which actually in the end turns out to be greenwashing. I think there's one famous example is Ford's amazing green HQ that it built, which a lot of ESG types kind of lauded. But actually their progress on actually producing electric vehicles hasn't been that amazing at all. Whereas a company like Elon Musk's, which perhaps doesn't have the greatest plaudits for its governance and things like that, is actually producing a lot of electric vehicles and a lot of batteries and a lot of solar panels. So it's a case of what really matters.
What does really matter?
Well, you know, I think basically what really matters for investors are companies which aren't only addressing, you know, the important bits for their business. In terms of making sure they're protected from, regulation and things like that, and protected from other, you know, idiosyncratic risks which can, come out of, the whole environmental agenda. But people are offering kind of solutions to other people. So in this week's tip section, we write about a company called Kingspan, which is a leader in insulation. And the amount of carbon emitted by construction is massive. And so any company which can offer really good solutions is likely to do very well. And Kingspan is, investing in product innovation, offering, really great products, really, deeply in with its customers and is doing fantastically well. Also another company that I wrote about in my Ideas Farm write-up was Boohoo.
Fast fashion doesn't sound very green.
Fast fashion doesn't sound very green, but it is, it says it's making the right noises. I mean, you know, time will tell that it's trying to be a far more sustainable business. And you've got this quite interesting situation with Boohoo, which is they source a lot of their products from factories in Leicester, where there have been lots of criticisms of how those factories are run. It's kind of seen as a kind of dystopia of the onshoring model. So, lots of people are reported to be working in terrible conditions and below minimum wage, et cetera, et cetera. However, if you're a company like Boohoo, which has scale and influence, you can essentially create a competitive advantage by forcing your suppliers to adhere to higher standards, and thereby making it harder for other competitors to get in on your market. So in some ways, by kind of the, you know, the regulations there from a legal standpoint, it may not be being enforced at the moment, but someone who can actually enforce it is a big, powerful business. And then it makes it harder for other small businesses, competitors, to actually muscle in. You're doing good if you like, but you're creating a competitive or you're strengthening your competitive position.
It's quite interesting, you know, the whole idea of reshoring, because one of the things that COVID-19 has showed up is kind of how global supply chains are. And there's been a lot of talk of bringing stuff back. I mean, is this something we can expect to see from more companies, particularly in the fashion industry?
Well, it's definitely what's being talked about. I mean, the other term is deglobalization that people are talking about. I mean, there's, you know, you can see the sense in it because, it, you know, supply chains have been, you know, their frailties have shown up during the COVID-19 lockdown. But whether people forget about it or not, obviously, you know, it's good. Time will tell. But there could be a lot of money that a lot of companies need to invest in their supply chain. So as well as there being beneficiaries, we could see a lot of companies who have really, stretched their working capital, kind of like reduced their working capital significantly by not investing in their supply chain. They could have big bills to pay as we come out of lockdown, get back to normal, as it were.
I guess that's something we're always mindful of when we're looking at companies that we potentially tip to our readers. Getting back to the idea of futurology, I guess as the tips editor and, you know, somebody who likes stock markets generally, the future is something you're always having to think about. How do you try and frame the future when we're looking at companies and their prospects?
Well, I think it's a lot of it's kind of best guessed kind of stuff because no one knows the future. The future, you know, there's so many things which are unpredictable. So really, if there seems to be an intelligent consensus, it's worth following. But equally, you've got to expect it to as certain common sense visions of the future to prove false. Because there are lots of these things. There's no way of telling whether a trend will persist. Once a trend's established, there's a far better chance that it's going to keep on. Things are going to keep on moving in that direction. But it's the common sense is the key to investing. So it's like, you know, does it make sense? The more sense it makes, the more sense it makes to kind of, you know, base your investment decisions on, you know, whatever the particular trend is.
And one thing we're always quite wary of, and increasingly so, is the sort of blue sky stock picks that a lot of people get very excited about. I mean, where do people go wrong looking at these sort of companies that promise everything and seem to be based in some kind of trend that's actually happening?
Well, yeah, no, I mean, we're set up basically, in terms of our, you know, human behaviour, human psychology, you know. Greed and fear is the, you know, most basic way to see it. We're set up to kind of see these things which look too good to be true, but believe them and also overvalue them massively. And, you look at a company which is saying it's going to revolutionize X, Y, or Z, and then you look at the financial resources it has, the size of the industry it reckons it's going to exploit. And, you know, if it looks ridiculous, it normally is. I mean, you know, there may be, you know, that one company that, you know, is going to break the mold. But, you know, we see them time and time again, companies promising in the earth, saying they've got some amazing technology. And the idea that they're going to be the ones to commercialize it, if they, you know, even if they do have it, is, you know, ridiculous because of the amount, you know, that would be needs to be invested in it, the kind of partnerships they need to have, et cetera, is, you know, it's often just completely beyond them, especially if the industry requires scale. A lot of these companies which kind of purport to have something amazing operating in industries which, you have to manufacture and you have to have scale and you have to have a lot of capital put into your business and, you know, kind of a micro cap just doesn't fit the bill with those kind of things.
Yeah, we've had a bit of fun with a company like that not too long ago. That was, I won't name the company, save its blushes, but it was making or claiming to make lots of graphene, which it was commercialising. It seemed to have lots of deals, and everything seemed to be great. And we were always wary, but we were getting a lot of flack for that.
Well, yeah, people fall in love with these. I mean, it's you know, it's psychology at work, and we can, you know, if we're all honest with ourselves, you know, we can all appreciate how you fall in love with that kind of story, and like maybe, you know, maybe we do and have to. You know, and I'm sure. Well, I'm sure. You know, everyone does it. You know, who invests at times, but really, you know, that's the time when you need to take a cold shower and kind of get back down to earth. But if the trends that we're thinking are going to take off do take off, there will be loads of companies which you know, come out and say we're doing something, you know, really special in field X, Y, and Z, and you know they'll. Huge disappointments, and some of them will be outright frauds.
But you know, these trends are often real. You know, graphene is a real thing, and it offers to do amazing things. How do investors, but is there a better way for investors to try and tap into these trends than by playing very speculative small caps that are promising the earth?
Well, you know, I think if you want to play that game, it's only going to work if you've got a really wide spread of holdings, because inevitably some will be duds, and you know you're just looking for that one which, you know, goes to the moon. So you know, it's funds would be the way for a private investor to get into it,
or trusts,
or trusts, and probably trusts, because probably you're thinking about I mean, you know, if you've got a decent technology, if you've got a really decent proposition now, you don't need to come to the public markets. So I don't know if that's going to change, you know, given what's going on at the moment. But yeah, you can finance everything off market. So private equity investment trusts, which are a great way to hold a broad spread of private equity holdings. I mean, they, you know, they're one of the options that people should be looking to. I mean, to buy one share in a company whose story you've fallen in love with, but has no kind of way of substantiating it. Apart from, you know, it could be some kind of, you know, really flaky deals, or, you know, who knows what. But you know, if there's no really good way of a company substantiating what it's claiming, I mean, you probably should not be holding that individual share.
Mm. I mean, Scottish Mortgage is a big favourite of Investors Chronicle readers. And that gives you access to kind of, you know, the very biggest companies in technology, and also, you know, a lot of smaller companies that are on the cutting edge of science. I mean, Tesla is one of its biggest holdings. We've already talked about them. But technology is a really big thing in Scottish Mortgage. Technology is really a really big thing in markets altogether. We've already discussed it on this podcast. I mean, for a UK investor, it's really hard to get access to technology through the London Stock Exchange. Lots of small companies there. But also, you know, it always seems very expensive. And how are we approaching technology from the point of view of giving our readers ideas around that sector? It's tough in the UK.
Yeah, no, it's tough in the UK. We're looking to give people more ideas in international markets. So looking to the US in particular for tech ideas. I mean, in the UK, you don't really have much to choose from, especially in the most exciting side of tech, which is the software companies and some of those big online retail propositions. Although we do have some, you know, pretty exciting online retailers.
Yeah, Boohoo among them.
Yeah, and then we've got some interesting niche online media companies like Rightmove and Auto Trader. So, you know, there are, you know, tech stroke media players out there, but or just disruptors, I guess you could call them. But the US is really home to the most exciting companies. I mean, there are exciting companies in China as well. Alibaba, Tencent, that you know, those kind of companies. But then it comes with a lot of kind of governance risk.
And you've also got valuation risk in the tech sector as well. I mean, everyone is chasing these companies. Yeah. They're seen as the future. Can they live up to those valuations?
Well, I mean, I think already, you know, I mean, I think for some years you can look at that sector and say, it just looks too rich, the multiples people are being asked to pay. But we do have this exceptional situation where the cost of borrowing is, it's disappeared. There isn't any cost to borrowing. There's no you know, there's no alternative, is what people have been saying for a long time. And there's even less of an alternative now. So, you know, where does that leave valuations? It's kind of, you know, I think a lot of people have been scratching their heads saying this looks like a very expensive market for absolutely ages. But what do you do? I mean, and, you know, and in this environment, there's a logic that the best companies, those companies which can create huge returns and reinvest them into growth, those companies have a really, really huge value, because the value of future earnings is so much greater when interest rates are low.
I mean, the thing about technology as well is that there has been hanging over it for some years, all this the idea that the politicians are going to go after it on the basis that it invades privacy. It, you know, it's too powerful. I mean, do you think that risk has disappeared as a result of this crisis?
No, I think one of the things which investors should be watching out for is just how politics develops, because I think a lot of the narratives that we've had, especially in America, could be amplified by what's happened now. I mean, when we had the bank bailout, we saw a lot of animosity towards the banks, and that had significant repercussions for them. You could see something similar with the corporate sector as a whole, and the most profitable companies are likely to be most vulnerable in that situation. I suppose you've got the whole thing about monopoly power, which is a real kind of, you know, big argument in the States, especially before COVID, and you've also got the argument about share buybacks and the amount of damage that they do to the interests of stakeholders as a whole. And the fact that a lot of companies which have been doing huge amounts of buybacks are now getting loans to essentially prop up the balance sheet, which could have been propped up by the money which has been to shareholders. And also the fact that a lot of people profiting the most from the crisis are the, you know, monopoly-esque big tech companies, which there's been a lot of political heat on.
But they haven't been asking for loans. They're not the ones that have been asking for loans. And in fact,
haven't been asking for loans. They've been profiting a lot from supplying things people want, but also from their monopoly position. So that's the kind of narrative which was there before, which people are likely to get more, or could get more heated about. I mean, I don't know. You know, in this election in this year in America will tell us a lot about how the population's feeling and how politicians want to play this. But you have them profiting more from their monopoly position, and you also at the same time have companies which were buying back a lot of shares now asking for loans. And we just have to see how livid people are, and just the kind of like the whole populist background to politics at the moment means there could be, you know, real ramifications for the way companies are treated, regulated, and taxed. So until something happens, we don't know. But I think it's something definitely worth keeping an eye on.
So the U.S. election this year is a big one. It matters. It will matter to the markets possibly more than it has for some time.
Well, I think they all matter a lot for the market. But, I mean, it's going to be particularly interesting to see where the debate goes, where the narrative goes.
Yeah, lots to pay attention to. Thanks, Algie.
Thanks.
That is all we have time for this week, I'm afraid. But there is plenty of other stuff in the magazine, including lots more from Chris and another piece from Mr. Bearwell that ties in very nicely with our theme of life after COVID, looking back to the Roosevelt era. As you may have guessed, Phil is away this week, or rather he is at home but having a week off. But he did file his mag column before he disappeared, and it's on another one of the big tech giants, Apple. And Michael Taylor is asking the question that's on so many of our minds: when will the pubs open again? And specifically JD Weatherspoon, which is looking out for a potential trade. Dave Baxter has gone investment trust bargain hunting in the fund section, and they'll be recording their podcast tomorrow. We've got lots of results back in this week, including a surprise entry for Marks and Spencer, which came on Wednesday, and another blow to income seekers in the form of Imperial Brands. And there is loads of fascinating news this week, including the start of another series that we're running, looking at transportation after lockdown, getting Britain back to work. We have key questions for the housing market, and inspired by Games Workshop's fascinating deal with Frontier Developments a few weeks ago, we're looking in detail about how investors can get their head around intellectual property, which is the lifeblood of the gaming industry. So, thank you all for listening, and thanks to all our guests, Chris, Alex and Algie, and of course to my excellent co-host Megan, who has also written the cover feature this week and masterminded the series we'll be running fortnightly for the next few months. The New Future, how investors can ready themselves for the world of disruptive change unleashed by COVID-19. Pick up the magazine in all good newsagents, or get online and subscribe if even the sun hasn't tempted you out of lockdown yet. Take care and speak soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.